Visions with the Rob podcast. Today we're excited to be joined by Professor Jamie Morgan from Leeds Beckett University and Professor Heikki Patomäki from the University of Helsinki. Jamie Morgan is a professor of economics. His research interests include political economy, philosophy of economics, and global governance. He has written extensively on critical realism, global finance, and climate policy. And Heikki Patomäki is a professor of world politics and global political economy. His research interests include philosophy, economic theory, global political economy, big history, future studies, and global justice and democracy. And Jamie and Heikki have collaborated extensively on developing the idea of a global greenhouse tax. Heikki was also a guest at our most recent panel where we discussed the possibility of a global carbon tax. So firstly, thank you both for being here today. And I was hoping to begin the discussion by hearing your comments on our previous panel, as Jamie has also watched some of it and Heikki was a guest there. So were there any thoughts you wanted to share with us after the panel on the global carbon tax?
Well, perhaps Jamie, you could start.
First thing, everybody talks very, very slowly, which I'm not quite used to. Apologies if I talk quite quickly in comparison. It did strike me whilst watching it that whilst it did come up several times, nobody was really asking, why did we end up with, you know, an emissions trading scheme? Why was that the preferred solution? I mean, people mentioned lobbying, etc., but there's a particular reason why we ended up with that. People with power and influence in lobbying, you know, wanted that system. The very fact that they wanted that system should ask us questions about its efficacy in terms of what our goals are as a species and what their goals are as people who are running corporations, and they look at these things as constraints on profitability and inconveniences to deal with, which are institutionally imposed to require them to do things which are not their core concerns. Now then, if they want a system, your first question to ask as a skeptic, you know, and I don't mean a conspiracy theorist, as a skeptic, is to ask, why is that the preferred system? You know, I mean, one of the participants, you know, he said several interesting things. Yeah, you know, he described several of the early elements of the design of the European ETS, and he suggested they were mistakes, and some of them are clearly mistakes, but equally they were negotiated opportunities, right? And that's a very different mindset. No neoclassical model starts out from the idea that people have power and interests and will negotiate and change their own conditions of operation. It assumes that they take the institutions as a given and work within them, and every individual is in a position of trade-off with no individual power because the system itself prevents that. And yet no real-world situation is like that. Nor do you design the system that you want from scratch. You have a world in which you are having to negotiate with actors in order to get the outcomes you want based on what they will allow you to happen. You know, if you thought about what the world was like, the ETS was a very obvious outcome of a thing, yes, in terms of a negotiating process, at the same time as it's not the best possible outcome, is it? You know, and equally to say that the fundamental problem we had was setting the right price misses the point that over time you are never going to get away from all of the motivations which mean they will always be trying to undermine what it is you're trying to do. Without themselves thinking of themselves as climate criminals, that's not how people think. Nobody thinks of themselves as the bad guy, but they have a set of interests, don't they? Yeah. And so many things can go wrong in that situation. I mean, it just continually kept occurring to me that nobody was asking and then developing the fundamental problem of why you might think of this as a suboptimal outcome and therefore automatically be thinking there must be alternatives to this, right? And well, that's where I would start in terms of the carbon tax, to be honest.
Right. I mean, there's actually a political history to this. I mean, the European Union was considering and also advocating in the late 80s and early 90s, it was advocating a carbon tax instead of emission trading system. And what happened was that the US, in the negotiations that led to Kyoto Protocol of 97, I mean, the US was pushing this line that, I mean, it's better to have a market-based system rather than the a taxation system. And the EU basically surrendered and gave up the idea of taxation. There might have been also political changes within European countries and the EU as well. the EU was only established itself, or was established only at this time. But then there were a number of civil society organizations like Greenpeace, for instance, that were advocating the idea of the tax. But they also, by the early 2000s or so, I would need to check the exact years, but they gave up this idea also in the name of political realism. They started to think that given that what is happening is the building of emission trading systems, this is the only realistic alternative, and because we are interested in getting less emissions, I mean, this is the best possible world given the current political circumstances that we can get. I mean, that was the political history of it. I mean, of course, there's the history in terms of ideas, neoclassical economics, and also the kind of abstract context, but this is the concrete political history of it.
Well, as one of the people in the one of the participants suggested during the discussion, I mean, you started out in particularly in the EU ETS, you started out with low prices for permits, and recently prices have risen, and this was considered to be an improvement, right? But again, this fails to understand the overall context. A higher price is not a successful price if it cannot solve the problem it is set to solve. Those higher prices are not significant to the extent that they've made the pricing of permits a significant issue in terms of trading. The cap is the only thing that currently matters. The trading of them is not a significant cost. It's making any difference to the investment in technology or behavior. Those two things are not actually aligning. So considering it as a market mechanism to do something, if it is, it's still a dysfunctional one, right? Mm-hmm. And as an overall solution, why do we call it realistic to use an institutional design which will fail, right?
Well, I only call it politically realist from the point of view of the actors who participated in the process in the 90s and early 2000s.
But I appreciate that, Hank. It was more of a rhetorical question rather than a "that's what you think."
Well, I mean, I've been always in favor of tax as a better solution, but it's, even a tax is not enough. If you look at what has happened, I mean, the thing is that there were more emissions than ever before in 2024, and the same goes for the previous years as well. And the problem has actually been getting worse all the time. And even in the European Union, that is perhaps very often is used as a kind of an idealized example of how the trading system might work, there has been only at best a relative decoupling between economic growth and the emissions, but not absolute decoupling. The thing is that the European Union might look relatively good in terms of emissions simply because there has been very little economic growth in the EU, but this decoupling hasn't actually happened. And because the world economy as a whole is growing still at the rate of 3% per year or something like that, it means that we are going to get even more emissions in the foreseeable future. And given that there's a delay in the emissions and their ultimate effects on climate, that a delay is in the order of between 5 and 30 years. So it takes quite a few years before the full effect of the current emissions are played out in the system. So we can now see that the global warming or heating is going to continue at least for the next 30 years, even if we stop entirely all the emissions in the world immediately.
But we're not
we
going
no
to do that.
This.
We're just not doing that.
No, we're not doing that. And
the emissions last year was, I think, the UNEP emissions gap. I think it was 57 gigatons CO2e and 37 gigatons just for energy use. Current energy use is about 30,000 terawatt hour. Some of the estimations for 2050 put that at 60,000, so doubling. Right. If we follow that line, new data centers, use of AI, all of those things, more and more electric vehicles, electrification of everything and economic growth. And then we replicate that around the world as every other country supposedly does catch up. So we have a world of, you know, the same equivalent levels of wealth and consumption. How exactly is that going to be compatible with solving this problem?
Exactly. And I think a global greenhouse gas tax would be a major step forward, but even that is not sufficient in its own. You need much more. But that would be a major step forward in many ways, not least in terms of actually having an impact, depending, of course, on the price of carbon. But it would have an impact on behavior and reduce. Help to reduce emissions, particularly if the tax is high enough. But then the other side of the coin is also that it will yield revenues that can be in part channeled to a global fund, which then can be used to both to address this problem and also mitigate the consequences of global warming. And this will be a major issue because one of the consequences of this global warming is likely to be the intensification of conflicts also in the interstate field. Unless there's a cooperative system in place that somehow can compensate and somehow address the question of climate justice, it is very likely that we are going to see even a more conflictual world in the future, in part because of this. I mean, the link is, of course, complex and indirect, but I see that there are all kinds of tendencies into that direction.
Okay, but equally, I mean, that's a focus on the particular policies which you think are effective. And but as you also said, there's a need to have this work in conjunction with other policies to do other things which allow this to be effective to solve the problem that you do in fact have. I
Indeed.
mean, you need something to be done about fossil fuel subsidies, for example. You need something to be done about the way in which we currently have a problem where the banking system heavily invests in counterproductive elements in terms of, say, fossil fuel production
I think
at
the
exactly the
figure
same time as
is
doing other things. Go on, sorry.
something like the figure is something like 700 billion a year that the banking system is now financing fossil fuel-based production.
Yeah, I mean, the latest Banking on Climate case report is something like that. That's true. But I mean, the only point I'm making there is, I mean, this is another problem of the siloing of policy. You can't look at one thing on its own. There are several other elements that need to actually be addressed at the same time in order for something to be effective. We have to keep in mind what the overall goal is. And the goal is a planetary goal. We're not all responsible to the same degree, not all countries, not all corporations, not all individuals, historically or now, at the same time as we will all suffer from the same problem. No, it is a collective action issue and it's a collective problem. It is a global problem.
Yeah, and we also don't know how these feedback mechanisms work and what some people call tipping points. I'm not particularly fond of that term, but the idea is that there are self-reinforcing processes and mechanisms that are released by global warming that further contribute to global warming. And we don't exactly know how those work. And there are all kinds of uncertainties, and many of them are playing against us.
Well, again, I don't want to get depressing, but there are several. I mean, since 2015, most of the new Earth system science and then the empirical observation of things have all been have all come to pretty much the same conclusion. Transitions and accelerations are occurring much faster than people thought, and in ways that were not previously properly understood. I mean, do you ever watch? And there's a really good podcast called Just Have a Think. It's by a person, he does a really good job of summarizing and making simple for the layperson recent scientific publications on cutting edge sa climate science. Have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't. No.
Anyway, I bullet pointed several here of ones that he's recently summarized. All right, so we've got okay, global heating underlying trends since 1970 showed a relatively steady increase of about 0.2 degrees per decade, but since 2015, that's accelerated. If you look at the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation System, the AMOC, again, there is some signs now that that's slowing down and may collapse. There are also signs of acceleration of ice loss from the Antarctic. That's a non-linear trend. And then probably the most worrying of these kind of things are changes to the El Niño Southern Oscillation System. So that's the Pacific flows of water, which then affect in terms of El Nino and La Nina, the cooling and the warming cycle thing. Now, then those tend to be asymmetric And it's never quite sure when it will switch from one to the other, but one of them augments and one of them slows down heating. Anyway, some of the latest modeling tends to indicate that those two will become more symmetrical. The switchover will have what they described as resonance and amplification, which would mean that you would get global heating that would result in extreme weather events at many places in the world at the same time. So you would get floods, you would get droughts, and you would get heat waves across great swathes of the planet all at the same time. And that is deeply worrying. Again, that's only a kind of set of forecasts based on an Earth system model. But it doesn't bode well, and it does basically speak to a fundamental issue that we've got here. There is still a pre-persuasion problem that we have. Before you can get people to accept different individual policies as part of a collective policy position, you have to get them to accept that climate emergency is real, the requirement for action is urgent, and policy changes are non-negotiable. We have to solve this problem, and we have to do so early. At that point, all of these problems about what is realistic are very different. Our realism is then focused on here is the actual planetary problem, as in the physical processes we have created, rather than here is what we feel like doing because we can negotiate between ourselves and we'll accept there's something we can do that is convenient for us. That's still where we are, though, isn't it? People are still thinking of this as an issue of, well, it's an individual cost, right? It's an economic decision. Is it convenient for me and can I afford it? We are not thinking about this as collective community civilizational planning for survival of the species, which is in the long term what this is now. And yet we are not thinking that way, because if we were, we wouldn't be having these kind of conversations.
Well, I mean, who is this we are talking about? Because obviously you, for instance, and I think I as well, we already have kind of a planetary imaginary, and
You
this is
say that.
actually one of the collective or things that are related to collective learning. I mean, it has to be precisely about or with this enlargement of our political imagination that so far has been captive of state sovereignty. I mean, people only think alternatives in terms of their own state, and this is the we that most people are considering. But when you put it things like you just did, I mean, the El Nino oscillation and the how they amplify each other and how these things are connected, I mean, the Antarctic ice and all the rest of it. I mean, you actually have a kind of a very vivid way of portraying how things are interconnected on a planetary scale. And that requires also planetary political imagination as well. And I think the global greenhouse gas, the gas tax could be kind of a manifestation of that imagination in place. I mean, that could be a concrete step forward in thinking about how to reorganize politics to make this planet sustainable, livable place for the hundreds and thousands of years to come.
Well, whilst I appreciate when you question the we, and that's a classic rhetorical move in academia, isn't it? If I was to say, well, look at the metrics, the planetary scale metrics, and then watch the TV, and then tell me you don't think that that's the mindset in the world right now. When people, how do people feel on the average? They feel powerless, and most of the time, they feel dread. It's not fear, it's dread. It's this idea that there's something inevitable that is coming that I have no agency to affect. At the same time as there's been this kind of resurgence of skepticism, thanks to, a US-led change in opinion, let's call it that. Yeah. And there's a kind of zeitgeist of either give up or hide, and which is deeply counterproductive. And by that, I mean in places which could actually matter for agency. Yes. I mean, a lot of the world is going to suffer from this and has less agency. In places where there could be agency, there is a whole lot of other distractions. I can't afford this. But people should not be put in the situation of we're expecting them to afford this. We should be thinking about ways of doing this which make it a community issue where we are distributing the costs in a realistic manner. But the more we privatize the problem and solutions, the less we think that way. The more we let economists talk about this, the more it becomes an economic problem, and then it becomes a problem of economic agency, cost-benefit analysis, and can I afford this thing? But really, this is not an economic problem, right? This isn't an economic problem. Our economies have created it, but it is not an economic problem. It's a
Well, it's
social
not.
redesign problem.
It's also that. I mean, that's part of the thing, but it's not the essence of it. But it's also an economic problem as well. The
Well, economists can talk about it, but every time they do, we end up with horrible answers.
Yeah, but I'm not advocating neoclassical economics here in saying that this is also an economic problem or political economy problem. But anyway, the sense of lack of agency is actually something that is also very concrete. I mean, there's a dialectics of institutions and imagination. In the absence of adequate global institutions where some sort of politics, where there's political space and some democratic politics can take place, and in the absence of transformative political agency on a world scale. I mean, what we have are these movements and parties and so on that are only within the confines of the national states. And even
I'll
in the
just remind
European
you
Union,
something.
there's very little in terms of European politics. And so it is not totally baseless for people to actually think that they lack agency because they see very little places where they could participate and play a role in world politics.
Yeah, but you don't have agency, and you do not have agency until you realize you have it. You
Yeah,
can't
but
use agency you refuse to accept that you have. So it's a mindset problem before it's anything else. And that's a pre-persuasion problem before you can have any particular individual policy. And I'll refer you back to the things we've just said about economics. I don't mean that it isn't a problem of industrial economics or industry or economies and consumption as well. I don't mean it's not that problem, right? But consider what it's been made by economists, right? If you still look at the main models that are being created, you know, these integrated assessment models, right? What is the loss of GDP from growth by the end of the century? It's between 10 and 20%. What's the optimal warming that they're estimating between 2.7 degrees and 4? That's what they are saying is optimal based on an economic model. Now, you tell me that that isn't insane.
Well, I agree with you. So there's no discussion here. Yeah, but what is actually happening? I mean, on the basis of, as you said, I mean, the global warming seems to be accelerating, and it seems to me that if you simply extrapolate that acceleration, we are going to reach 2 Celsius degree warming compared to the pre-industrial levels by 2040s, and then almost, or perhaps 3%, 3 Celsius degree already in the 2060s. So we are way beyond that optimal level of the economist already in the 2060s.
But we're also falling into the trap of discussing temperatures as if somehow these average temperatures are what matter. You know, if that's all it was, an average temperature in one place or another, then that would be insignificant. Right? It's the extreme weather impacts and climate changes that go along with it which matter.
Another
The
way of
tail
putting
effects in a system,
yeah,
the
another way of putting it
instability.
is what matters is the amount of energy that is actually trapped into the atmosphere and oceans due to global warming. I mean, it's a
Well,
huge amount compared to, for instance, nuclear explosions or anything. I mean, the amount of energy is beyond human imagination.
when you say it matters, consider what that matters to, because it won't matter to the planet. The planet won't go away, but our capacity to produce provisioning systems for 8 billion people will go away, because where will be the agricultural systems? Where will be the water systems? Where will be the degree of certainty for planning in places which will allow places to be habitable? And it doesn't mean habitable from, you know, month to month, to year on a daily basis. You know, those things are again something we should be sufficiently worried about to make us engage in action now. They're not things we should orient on to the point where again we have debilitating fear. There should be reasons to act. They should be part of rational engagement of argument to make us do things now. Because the power that we have is not to invent technologies which will solve a problem in 50 years' time or 25 years' time based on transitions, if we get lucky, based on investment. The power we have now is social redesign to stop ourselves doing things. And then, in conjunction with that, produce investment which produces technologies which may help us with that problem. What we have now is a okay, if we just keep investing, somehow these technologies we are producing will solve these problems. I mean, that's just hugely reckless.
Yeah, the thing is that this is much more political than what the this idea that the this matter of common human survival or something like that indicates. I think that the situation currently is that the richest 1% of the world population produce as much emissions as the poorest 50% of the world. This 1% is the one that is likely to survive no matter what. I mean, even if the worst scenario comes true, I mean, the richest people, the wealthiest people are able to escape this problem. Whereas the rest is the one that are going to suffer. And I think that is one of the key arguments in favor of a system of taxation that shouldn't be limited only to greenhouse gas emissions, but also to many other things like capital or wealth.
Just to be
And that.
clear, those people will not survive. Those people will create the conditions for some people to survive. But if you put yourself in a bunker, right, with your security team, right, at that point, what does Elon Musk have to offer them?
Yeah, but I mean, this scenario is pretty extreme. I mean,
You offered that scenario. You said the 1% survive.
it's not a nuclear war.
Irrespective.
It is. I think that it is easy to also to exaggerate the effect on humanity. Even in the worst possible scenario, I mean, the majority of humanity is likely to survive into the 22nd and 3rd centuries. And of course, there will be reduction of population also independently of global warming as well. I mean, we are going to reach the peak soon anyway. But it's still a kind of a political economy game of survival within this kind of a society where the conditions for proper living are going to become more scarce because of global warming.
Everything you've just said is predicated on the basis of sufficiently gradual changes and events which are crises for us to respond on the basis of the majority population in places being able to cope or people cope on their behalf, right? How many people live in Tokyo now?
I don't know the exact figure. I think it might be something like 15 million.
I think it's more than that, isn't it? Whatever it is, it's a massive number of people, isn't it? Imagine provisioning that on the basis of scarce food, based on the fact that we'd had multiple failures of crops around the world all at the same time. Again, you could call that scaremongering, and it is to a certain extent, isn't it? My point is, there is an assumption being made if you say that the majority will survive under some conditions. That fails to take into account how many of us are dependent on others for our provisioning in long supply chains that run over the year for food provision for that year. All of that is based on transport and electrification, right? And also a relative stability of food production. And then the fact you can depend on different countries to provide what you lack at particular times in a year. But if scarcity becomes a genuine issue of scarcity, none of that can be assumed to be true. We're imagining a future world based on a current world when the conditions of the future world will not be ours. And if there are, within that situation, very, very rapid changes or events at some points, right? You don't get to repeat those things because the impacts have already been had. You can't say, well, they'll cope next time, because it's already happened. It only has to happen once in each case. So I think it's somewhat, underappreciating the nature of the situation and say, well, the majority will probably survive. It may be terrible and it could be better, but most people will survive and that will be okay. But even if that is true to some degree, what kind of civilization will we be living in for something that we can be making decisions now to avoid those problems? But before you answer that, we do seem to be getting onto things which are much more like, fairly, dystopic science fiction rather than a discussion of carbon taxes. So why don't you discuss the nature of the institutional mechanisms at a global level that you think would be relevant to that problem, rather than us mire in depression.
Well, I mean, my point was actually not to say that it is a comforting vision to think that the majority of humanity will survive no matter what. I mean, even though I think this is the case, but the point was rather to say that this is a highly political thing, that there are many issues that concern things like justice and who is responsible for this and who are the ones who are likely to be okay in various ways, even under the worst circumstances. And in that view, I think that we need to establish mechanisms on a global scale that can actually address this political issue. And this has two sides. I mean, one is that we have mechanisms like taxation and also resource generation that can be used for to compensate for the uneven effects of this and also uneven past developments as well, and then redistribute wealth on a global scale. Some sort of economic planning seems to be necessary in the future for this reason. We need various other elements as well, obviously. The global greenhouse gas tax is one of my favorite ideas because it addresses so many issues simultaneously. But as said, we need many other mechanisms, and some of them have to do with more the technical part and the, like, I mean, what should be done at the level of concrete actions, the reforestation of the planet, and some other things. But we need also these political economy mechanisms and political mechanisms to allocate resources for those kinds of purposes and to do things differently and address also the political issue. And in order to avoid this kind of a Hobbesian war against all against all, I mean, we need to have also spaces where this can be addressed in terms of peaceful politics. So people can struggle over the future courses of action and policies and institutional transformations in a peaceful way and still having some kind of an idea of the we that is not limited to one particular group only. But I wonder, I mean, we've been talking quite a lot and spontaneously with the Max and Astrid. Do you have any particular questions or points in mind?
Well, in the beginning of your discussion, you mentioned the previous times when we took the road of emission trading systems. So I was wondering how could or would the world look today if you would have chosen the carbon tax system instead of those emission trading systems earlier?
That's a very interesting point and question. Jamie, what do you think?
Well, again, it would depend on how it was constructed institutionally. If it was done domestically by country, you would end up with a first mover problem, which is a reverse or negative issue in terms of where people chose to locate, unless you had a border tax as well. It would depend on the design of the carbon tax and how much of the world's economy it actually covered, and then the buy-in from corporations or the way in which you could force corporations to actually conform to its uses. Because as soon as you design a system, right, you create experts in that system who can be co-opted to undermine that system. That's the nature of capitalism, isn't it? Again, I don't mean that in a conspiracy theory sort of way. That's just how the human mind works in terms of ingenuity and the creation of opportunity. Yeah. So you've created a design issue as soon as you've done those. At what scale are you designing? Where does the institution lie? And what kind of expert are you going to put into that, which will then have control over how it responds to other actors' movements?
Yeah, the thing is that the only reasonable way of establishing this kind of a system is by way of a relatively large coalition of the willing, and that then they have to establish not only a greenhouse gas tax or at least carbon tax within the system, but they also need this border levies as well. I mean, otherwise the system doesn't work, and there is no incentive to join the system, and so on. So, I mean, that would be, I think, a necessary condition for any reasonable design for a global greenhouse gas tax. If that had happened in the past, I mean, the thing is that, let me put it this way, that we have lived in neoliberal era since the 1980s. I mean, it started to emerge in the 1970s, but by the late 1980s, it was already hegemonic globally. And this current system, which is market-based, very much reflects the hegemony of neoliberalism in the world. If something like a global greenhouse gas tax had been established already in the 1990s, it would have indicated a different course of world history, basically, toward a more global Keynesian direction, in my view, to the extent that there is some resource allocation on a global scale, some macroeconomic policy, public investment programs, and so on. All these would be very different from the system that we have at the moment. And it is very hard for me to imagine that this would have happened like as an isolated event, but rather there would have had to be some kind of a wider process of transformation towards something else. And the conditions might not have been there in the 1990s. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, the European Union, yes, as I said earlier, I mean, was advocating a tax system rather than trading emissions in the 90s, early 90s, and late 1980s, early 90s. But whether it would have been a global system in the sense that we are discussing now is a different matter. Because we have to remember that the EU was founded in the Maastricht Treaty in 92 and 93. And it became a very neoliberal, one of the manifestations of this rising and consolidating hegemony of neoliberalism in the world. I mean, the EMU is a very neoliberal design. So it's very difficult for me to imagine that that kind of a European Union would have advocated something that is fundamentally different from the current order. And perhaps this is a tragedy. I mean, of humanity and the planet as well, because this became the hegemonic under circumstances of the consequences of the great acceleration of the 20th century. And these were in part independent processes, at least politically speaking. So all of a sudden, I mean, the world found itself in a situation where something that is totally detrimental from this environmentalist perspective, given the great acceleration and its consequences. But the reasons for that had nothing to do with the environment per se. It had to do with the changes in power relations in global political economy, the discrepancy between territorial states and the world economy, liberal world economy, that changed power relations and the paved the way for this neoliberal line of thinking about competitiveness of the state and the free constitu kind of neo-constitutionalizing free market principles and free trade principles
Stop.
to international organizations.
Stop.
Okay.
That was a very long answer and very depressing. Do you know what you just did?
No.
You just essentially said that we would have needed a different world with different conditions to produce an outcome we would have preferred. If that is so, that is the case now, just as it was then. At any point in time, there have to be levers to allow you to change the way the world is in order to get the outcomes you would prefer. And that has always been true. There have to be ways of doing that. Otherwise, what you've just said is deterministic to the point of being just the world is terrible and was bad there. We wouldn't have got the carbon tax and we won't get it now. Equally,
Yeah, I
the
understand
short
your
answer to your question, though, is not that one. It is you
point.
have to decelerate the growth of energy demand in order to allow a disruptive carbon tax to impact in such a way as it can keep pace with changes in energy demand, such that things like renewables can overtake in an energy system. But otherwise, in terms of the balance of forces, you will always have a situation where the carbon tax itself will break down because there will be too much resistance to it over time. You
Yeah.
need that situation. That's the mechanism you need. I don't know how you're going to do that, but that I would suggest is the practical focus of this deceleration of energy demand growth at the same time as a disruptive carbon tax, and then redistribution and recrediting within the carbon tax so that you have a just outcome from that.
Right. But I would like to go back to this possibility of alternative world history. And so there are different conjunctures, and there are also critical junctures in world history. One of them was in the 1970s, late 1970s in particular, when the Bretton Woods system broke down. And I think that there was a real like possibility of going into a global Keynesian direction in that moment. And one of the expressions of this was the Brandt Commission report that came out a little bit too late. I mean, it came out in 1981. And actually, the whole expression global Keynesianism was originally the way of the critics of the Brandt Commission report to describe it. I mean, they said it's a global Keynesian, and they meant it that in a pejorative way. But in fact, I mean, the those who agreed with the report started to use the term global Keynesianism in a positive way. But I think there was a real possibility of going into a new kind of multilateralism, into that direction. And the initiative then was seized by the actors, particularly in the English-speaking world, in the UK and the US, who, and there were a number of things that also aided in this process, the complex things. I mean, the crisis of the state socialist system that occurred simultaneously. The war in Afghanistan was started in 1979, for instance, and that delegitimized the Soviet Union. And it was also increasingly facing economic trouble as well. China started to change and become more market, open market, the orientated. And there were a number of other political changes in the system. The system of collective or the world-making project to collective self-reliance was in crisis as well. And then came the end of the Cold War that very strongly reinforced these kinds of ideas in the world. But there was a moment, I think, then when things could have taken a different turn. There will be a new conjunctural possibilities and critical junctures also in the future. And the very
About
often,
now.
and perhaps now, but I mean, they can be based on a number of things. I mean, one is that there's some kind of a serious crisis, and that can trigger a development or generate that kind of a moment, critical juncture. And this has been theorized by many social scientists quite a lot, actually. I mean, how it operates and how it happens. And then there can be other changes as well. I mean, the political organization, I mean, creating new kinds of political forms of political agency, that's one part of the question. And that's the reason why I've been developing this idea of world political party, because I mean, that's one way of trying to realize something like that. It's also possible that we learn to anticipate the worsening of problems, especially in this area, global warming and the other ecological consequences, that we see the gradual deterioration of the situation and then learn to anticipate the worsening of the situation. And this is one of the possible ways in which world historical processes might actually lead us toward something quite different. So I don't see it as deterministic, but there are those periods of stability when something that has been consolidated, I mean, seems to continue no matter what. And then there are these periods when quite rapid changes might be possible as well. Of course, it also depends on the institutional arrangements, since it is possible to make institutions more open to changes. So it is a matter of how democratic they are and how open they are otherwise for alternative ideas and so on. I mean, the current system is not particularly good in that regard. And that my real concern is that there must be first a really pretty serious crisis, a global catastrophe of some sort, before the turning point comes. But of course, our responsibility is to do whatever we can, our utmost, to avoid that from happening and rather further transformations before that happens.
Waiting for a conjuncture to be convenient or appropriate for it to have the actions that we need now is arguing us into extinction.
Yeah,
Why
well,
is now not the right time to do a thing which is as urgent as it is? You also have a concept of self-transformative agency.
Now you're talking. Now you're talking about from a normative perspective. I think now is the right time. And what happened?
Now is the only time.
No, well, I argued that 20 years ago. It would have been the right time 20 years ago
Yeah,
already.
well, I can't act 20 years ago, can I? The only time I can act is now. I can't act in the future. I can't act in the past. Causation may travel over time, but the only time I can make a decision is now.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, the thing, well, we can make decisions also in the future, and all kinds of delays are possible, etc. But the thing is that even though normatively speaking, we should be acting now, and of course we do to the extent we can. But the thing is that as social scientists, when we try to understand the conditions of change, we can also talk about these kinds of different periods and conjunctures and critical junctures and so on. And this is a way of trying to understand how these conditions evolve in the course of our history. I mean, these are complementary, not contradictory things. I mean, we might have like a Kantian sense of responsibility to act right now, and that's correct. But then at the same time, as social scientists, we can also try to understand the conditions for change.
Yeah, but imagine this is a rhetorical move if you were trying to persuade some policymakers in government to do a thing, whilst you're also discussing the nature of conditions and what is conducive to doing things at particular points in time. You don't want them to think about that. You want them to think about the fact this is an urgent problem which we should be addressing now. Forget about everything else. Focus on this.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt. I think my question's going to, excuse me, overlap a little bit with Max's next question. But what I was thinking as you discuss this, especially the problem of now, is that, of course, we have these countries in the global south that are have experienced like the worst effects already. Like it's already just getting worse and worse for them. But like, do you see a future where these countries could come together in a way and implement their own type of carbon tax on the Western countries that have caused the actual problem? Would you see anything happening in a way? Because obviously, it's only going to get worse and worse for them. They're going to just, these places are going to be inhabitable. They already have scarcity of food and floods. And it's, even though we have had some effects in Europe, it's not the same as how they're feeling it. So, how do you feel like? Do you think there could be a shift in the next 50 years with
A
how?
coalition of the devastated rather than a coalition of the willing.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what that's what's my thoughts, and I'll let you guys.
It seems to me that initiative at the moment, if you're talking about the short-term future, is not going to come from North America or Europe. I mean, Europe is retreating as well. I mean, all the recent developments are going against the idea of Europe taking some kind of a lead or initiative on this front. So it might be that the initiative rather arises from a coalition of the devastated. That is possible. But in terms of actually making an impact on global warming, you need those who produce the problem. And so you need some of the big countries that are big in terms of the emissions that are responsible for the problem. Otherwise, it doesn't make much of a difference. But the initiative can come from those countries and others interested. I'm thinking about the BRICS countries. I mean, BRICS is pretty complicated in that regard because that includes also oil producing and fossil fuel dependent countries like Russia. And then China is an ambiguous case. I'm not quite sure about what to make out of the current policies and systems. I mean, they've been investing heavily, and the scale is totally different than in Europe in green transition. They produce a huge amount, huge capacity for the photovoltaic energy production and other things. I mean, renewable energy in one sense. But at the same time, because of the huge economic growth there, I mean, they've been also until very recently, I mean, there was a turning point right just now, but the but until recently, I mean, the emissions were also rising, and China is now responsible for more emissions than any other country. So but if China could take part in that kind of a coalition, I mean, that would make a big difference.
Let's still focus on a global carbon tax as at least one possible solution in solving this problem today. And let's now focus on the positive effects of it in a more holistic and comprehensive way. So, in your view, how should the revenues generated by a global carbon tax be allocated, and which approaches would be realistically implementable? Beyond reducing emissions, what additional positive developments might such a tax bring about?
Do you want to start, Jamie?
Me? No, I
Yeah.
think that's one for you, isn't it? You're the design of the mechanisms.
The potential revenues are really huge. I mean, if the price is high enough or the tax is high enough, I mean, like $60 per ton or even more, $100 per ton. I mean, and if the system was comprehensive, I mean, the most countries, at least the big emissions, they all included, then it could be up to 2% of the global GDP, which I've always considered to be a kind of a threshold for global macro, meaningful and efficient global macroeconomic policy to be possible. So that's really important. However, in order to get as many countries on board as possible, it is clear that even in the best of circumstances, I mean, part of the revenues must go to the states that are collecting the tax. So only part would be channeled to a global fund. But that could be up to 50% or even more of the total revenues. I think that there should be also some sort of redistributional justice in place here in thinking about these principles of allocation. That is that those countries that are historically most responsible for the problem, I mean, they could dedicate 70, even 80% of their revenues to a global fund, whereas the poorest countries that have least to do with producing the problem, they could keep most of the revenues and perhaps only allocate something like 10 or 20% to a global fund. And then it is also important that this global fund is organized in a democratic manner. But in this context, we need to think about democracy in a pretty flexible and multi-perspectival way, that there's interstate democracy, there's representative democracy through national parliaments, and then there's global civil society, component as well. It is possible to create that kind of a system, and in our publications, including the Journal of Environmental Management article and a chapter in my World Statehood book, we actually discuss some of those ways of organizing this organization. There could be a component of body that has to do with the representation of governments, and then another body that has to do with the more representative and participatory democracy. But all this is totally possible, and the design has, I mean, or these kinds of designs have been there for a long while. Now, I have to say one more thing, I mean, before giving this to Jamie, that even though this is our preferred way of organizing the global tax, there are many people who actually advocate a very different vision. And that vision is that the revenue should be redistributed almost immediately and almost totally back to the citizens of the world, rather so to make them more interested in actually establishing a tax like this. And there have been some surveys where people have been asked whether they're in favor of this kind of a global tax, and they are in favor, particularly they favor this model where the tax revenues are then redistributed to ordinary people and citizens. I don't think that's a very good idea, but there could be some kind of a compromise in terms, for instance, that some of the revenues that the countries keep could then be one way or the other earmarked for, let's say, social spending or something like that.
This raises a whole set of other issues because the carbon tax has to then integrate into energy pricing, and different countries have different institutions and mechanisms for how they set energy prices. The UK, for example, has one of the highest levels of energy prices in the G7, as far as I'm aware. We have a huge and growing problem with fuel poverty. So if you are not going to take that into account, and then you're going to introduce a carbon tax, which will effectively make energy more expensive, then you are going to cause a huge problem. However, if you are recrediting in that system, right, you also are recrediting across that system, and there is some potential that you are essentially feeding other emissions, in a consumption-based industrialized economy. You'd have to think carefully about what are the institutional mechanisms went along with it and how you would redesign your energy pricing system. So let's say, for example, the one we have in the UK is extremely inefficient. The energy price is set by the last unit that's provided for the energy for the electric production in the system, and that's usually gas or something else, and it's the most expensive unit sets the price, and it's not regional, right? It's national. So if we had a regional based one and it wasn't set on that basis, then you'd have a more competitive situation where some areas would have significantly cheaper energy, and then you would get relocation of industry to those, and you would therefore have industry being relocated to places where renewables dominated and they were at their cheapest. And that in itself would produce an economic mechanism that went along with a carbon tax, which was particularly punitive in other areas or across that system based on the redistributions or recrediting. So you would have to design the carbon tax in relation to energy policy and energy pricing. And that's a much thornier problem, but not an impossible problem.
I couldn't agree more, and I actually think that's the reason why the organization that controls the Global Fund and the taxation system has to be capable of learning and the open to changes. It has to be democratic, but it has to be also built in a way that it all the time is monitoring its own effects and learning from them.
So, could any existing models serve as a practical foundation for a global carbon tax? For instance, the Alaska Fossil Fuel Royalty System or the Climate Club, as presented by Willem Nordhaus.
That's your favorite idea, Jamie.
Well, I'm not a fan of William Nordhaus in the sense of he did, popularize models which have done untold damage in terms of the way they've misrepresented the relationship between economic growth, scale of economy, and impacts on the climate. Right? Everything about those models is fallacious, and that they've been a dangerous policy guide. I'm not blaming him as an individual. He used some fairly standard methods in economics, He applied them, they were popular, and that was his career. And he got a Nobel Prize in the end on the basis of all of that. But any ideas that he is proposing come tagged to an overall set of mechanisms that are supposed to be measuring the problem. Yeah. If you could disentangle the two, then I'd be more inclined to say that there was something there. But I'm not sure you can.
Yeah, but when he's talking about the this climate club, the ineffective coalition of the willing, I mean that can be disentangled from his overall framework. I think that idea is a good one. It doesn't matter where it comes from. Would you agree?
I'm not sure that's true.
Okay. I don't know whether there are any existing models because we don't have global tax organizations so far. First of all, I mean the systems of taxation have been developed fairly recently in world history. I mean income taxes didn't exist in the 19th century. I mean only in the late part of the 19th century they started to be established, except the UK that had a during the Napoleonic Wars they had a income tax, but that's only was meant to support war making, basically. But it was only later that those were established. There are some the attempts to create global cooperation in this field of taxation, and the I think the most promising of them is the I think it was 2020 agreement, G20 agreement, to set them at the bottom for corporate taxes at 15%. And there has been a tax competition, as we know, and it's a competition to the bottom. And now they've set a kind of a bottom line that nobody should go below 15%. And this of course, has implications to, even though none of the G20 countries is below 15% at the moment. But for instance, I mean, within the EU, Ireland is a good example. They have some, I think, 11 or 10.5% or something like that. So some countries are already below 15%. And so this is an example of attempt to cooperate on tax issues on a global scale. And even though it's not an example of how things should be organized, and once you have a tax organization and how it should be organized, at least it's a sign that there's some collective learning going on. And I think that's very promising.
I mean, equally, you can say the consolidated corporate tax base is what you need to make the corporation tax work. Yeah, I mean, is there an equivalent for carbon taxes in terms of avoiding the shifting of reporting of, carbon?
Yeah, that's true. And there have been such attempts, particularly in the European Union, for some 20 years already. But to no avail. I mean, there are still countries like Luxembourg and Ireland in the European Union that have been very strongly opposing these kinds of initiatives. And that's the reason why it hasn't been established. But the basic principles are already there. They've been systematically studied and criticized and discussed. And so the current designs for this common consolidated corporate tax base, they are pretty, I think they are pretty solid, and they could be implemented. And I don't foresee any major problems. It's only the lack of political will at the moment that we don't see any movement forward in that regard.
How do you see all of this, though, in terms of things like degrowth policies, in the sense of redirecting a lot of your economic activity towards basic welfare services and health services and all of those things, and changing the way in which people approach consumption? Because without those kind of elements of this as well, it's hard to see how this is actually going to fundamentally align with solving a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, did you actually want to say something?
Well, basically, I think my next question does go into that because I thought that you could have the opportunity to explain one of your favorite subjects, what a global Keynesian approach would be like for future development and economy, and it ties into that, obviously, how degrowth might be a part of that. So perhaps if you could shortly kind of include that in your answer and comment on what Jamie said. Thanks.
Yeah, the global Keynesianism, that's a big issue, of course. It is an attempt to think about economic policy and public policy in general in world terms. It's like domestic world economic policy, world social policy, and everything else together. It means some macroeconomic policy on a global scale, public investments on a global scale. Various systems of regulation on a global scale, an international clearing union with a non-national currency at the center of the world economy, world central bank, which can also generate funding for all kinds of global purposes, including those purposes that are related to the ecological problems, and then taxes, obviously, and redistributional mechanisms. So many of these functions and powers are, have been associated with democratic welfare states. So one could say that it is a matter of globalizing some of those functions and powers in a novel institutional setting and on a global scale. I don't think this is the end of world history, even if this is realized in one form or another. It's not the end of world history. It's only kind of an rational tendential direction of world history at this moment that we are living in the 21st century. That we need to have some possibility of democratic control over the development of the world economy as a whole, which actually means that it's a step toward building some control over our own history, the future of humanity and the planet. And we need to have those elements in place. They will not replace the states entirely. States will remain, but their position in this system will become very different from the current one. And the same holds true for many other things as well. I mean, there's always continuity in any change and transformation. And this is an open-ended process and depends on how and what the timing is of different initiatives happening and whether people can develop new ideas and not simply reproduce the old ideas on a different scale or something like that. What the actual outcome in any detail is going to be. But the thing is that this is the overall direction to assume more control over those mechanisms that determine the future of economic growth and more generally of the direction of world history.
Thank you.
What would you do first?
Basically anything. If there's any hope in getting any of these ideas through, I would be investing all my time and energy in supporting those initiatives. I mean, we've been working together on the idea of International Clearing Union. There will be a book out in February. I mean, that's a really important possibility. And that includes, for instance, I mean, the last chapter of that book has to do with the creating a special vehicle money or the asset of some sort that is based on this Keynesian idea of bancor. It is for ecological purposes and for the purposes of ecological transition. So creating special money on a global scale to fund the green transition, which is very much related to the idea of International Clearing Union, the main purpose of which is to make world economic growth more even, or even peak growth more even more stable, and also less prone to the trade wars and conflicts and weaponization of interdependence and so on. So all these ideas are connected. I would really love to develop something like that, but if the greenhouse gas tax is the one that is going to get some social forces behind it, and if it is the one initiative that moves forward, I mean, that would be my favorite one. But there are many other possibilities as well. I actually tend to think that any major breakthrough in systems of global governance into this direction will have effects on all the other processes as well. And this will start to change the entire context and scene for world politics in that sense. So it doesn't really matter where the breakthrough happens. I mean, the main thing is the breakthrough itself.
I mean, in climate terms, because as you've said several times, things that we do now and have done in the past will play out over a period of time into the future. So we've already created some of the future already in climate terms. And yet, at the moment, we're not really dealing with what it is that we've already done, which is already producing effects that are going to manifest. We're not thinking about the nature of the future that is going to exist as if that was a real problem now. No, we haven't accepted that our options are limited in terms of what we can do without causing catastrophic outcomes. And I think that is our fundamental problem. While that mindset remains,
Well,
we
always
have
when
an action problem.
you say this, I'm thinking about who this we is, because I mean, in the research community, for instance, I mean, there are so many people who are actually thinking exactly along the lines that you now say is not what we are
Okay,
thinking.
if I say we, I mean critical mass of public opinion such that you could get some reasonably radical policies passed. Because if you can't get that and you can't also get key agents within the political system on side, then it doesn't matter how much we discuss these things, right? We have agency to some degree. This discussion on the one hand, it is just talk. On another, it's something somebody may hear and change their opinion on a thing. And that could be good. Of course, it could be bad if we're, woefully misguided. But those things matter too. But at some point, we is our species, and we is the critical mass of us with agency to do things. It's not just a, well, as intellectuals, shall we sit here and consider the nature of we? We can do that for a long time, but rhetorically, yes, that is an issue. But clearly, there is an empirical issue of degrees of agency and critical mass of opinion.
Well, my point is not that you should be thinking about this, who is this we, but my point is that there has to be a kind of a smaller group of we that first develops these ideas and then they spread to society when the conditions are ripe for it.
I didn't know you were a Marxist with your vanguard of the proletariat there.
No, but you know, it's not, it has nothing to do with Marxism. I mean, somebody has to develop ideas. I mean, institutions are not possible unless there are first ideas for those institutions, and somebody has to develop them, right?
Yes. Equally, they have to be persuasive and put in the public domain to persuade people. And then the first designs of those things have to not be counterproductive in the way that they're implemented.
That is a very good and important point. So the designs, they have to be good ones, right?
But
And they
what
have
is
to
a
be
good design?
flexible.
We've already said that you need, at this stage, we need something relatively disruptive to current market systems. And that in itself means that you are not doing these things without consequences. You're not doing these without there being negative consequences in some respects. And that also is a situation we're now in. But we, at the same time, we've got a public discourse which refuses to accept there may be sacrifice involved in dealing with this existential problem. And that again is a serious issue.
Well, I think I would like to say, firstly, thank you so much for this conversation. I'm trying to be a bit more light with my final question, but I was thinking if you probably we should wrap it up, but if you have any final thoughts that you want to share where you consider a future where things might not be so bad, then do you have anything you want to leave us with apart from this coalition of the devastated versus coalition of the willing, which is one I'm going to keep in mind for the future?
Well, I don't think that we should be thinking about the future as some kind of a desperate thing that is going to hit us or something like that. I think there's plenty of hope also about better futures in many ways. And this is a kind of a necessary phase that we have to overcome in order to develop things that might go beyond anything that we can imagine at the moment in terms of institutional possibilities. What kinds of beings we are and what we do in this universe, not necessarily only on our planet. But the main task at the moment is to survive this critical and overcome this critical phase when we all of a sudden have created a planetary problem due to our own economic and other growth, including population growth. And I almost tend to see this in cosmic terms as some kind of a necessary phase that any civilization on any planet would have to face at some point. And now we are at this point. I mean, if we can overcome this, I mean, there are so many fantastic things that humanity can do.
Thank you, Heikki.
We face a basic tension, don't we? Yeah. On the one hand, the planet doesn't care about our good intentions. We'll either do what is sufficient in order for these things to matter, or we won't. At the same time, everything that pushes in the right direction is pushing us in the right direction and is better than nothing. We need to always be making the argument, though, we should be doing more at the same time as just pushing ourselves in the right direction. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. But equally, we just don't have the urgency now. We need urgency.
Thank you so much for taking the time today to discuss these issues with us. And I hope to read the book in February that's coming out, Heikki. And
Yes, that's
then
right.
also to see what you guys come up in the future as well with your research together. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.